The poet William Blake, in his Auguries of Innocence, begins with the lines, "To see the world in a grain of sand, and heaven in a wild flower, and hold infinity in the palm of your hand." Combining a metaphoric vision of the very familiar material perceptual world with a very unfamiliar ethereal notion, that of infinity. Mathematics is this pinnacle of abstract thought in the search for and the study of patterns, and is conjured up and created in our minds. It also provides a language that enables understanding the world as we observe it and the world as we might imagine and create it. And so it's surely remarkable that these abstract ideas allow us to describe and predict the world outside our window, and even more, perhaps, that we can effectively bend matter to do our will by thinking and calculating before manipulating it. For example, it allows us to understand how sand flows, how flowers bloom, and how organisms like you and I build ourselves, themselves. And it is the foundation, mathematics is the foundation of how to manipulate matter and create art, artifacts, tools, and machines, even if you are only subliminally aware of it. This is the realm of Middle Earth, where mathematics is increasingly finding inspiration from the scale of patterns in space and time in the observable everyday world, includes biology and chemistry, and eventually enables engineering. In Middle Earth, phenomena are familiar, but their causes and consequences are not, as they pile on top of each other in more and more complex ways. In fact, complex, from the Latin complicare, comes associated with fold together. I'm going to tell you about some problems, all of which have little adventures associated with folding. Of our work in this area, which have to do with how matter is organized in space and time, on the scale of the Earth itself, on scales associated with thousands of kilometers, on the scale of ourselves and trying to understand, for example, the organization of the brain, and on the scale associated with the kinds of art and artifacts that we essentially create, using mathematics to describe, using mathematics to predict, and eventually using mathematics to essentially design. My first example is associated with, as I said, understanding our home, Earth itself. The most obvious feature of our planet is that it's a spheroidal, watery surface. And if you look a little more carefully, you look at islands, you can see volcanoes. And when you look at these islands and volcanoes very carefully, you essentially see that they lie along arcs. And that's very common, close to home near the Caribbean, further away near Japan, further north from here, the Aleutian Islands associated with Alaska, and many, many other places. Okay, so you have a sphere which is mostly covered with water. You look closely, you see that watery surface pockmarked, and associated with these pockmarks, you see islands. And these islands sit along curves. And so one can ask, why do these patterns arise? How can we do so? So I'm going to use an analogy, a metaphor and an analogy, and I'm going to use an analogy to something that you're familiar with. The Earth is spherical. On the Earth, we have magma which is coming up, associated with the mid-Atlantic oceanic ridges. That magma is hot, it rises to the top, it starts to cool. As it starts to cool, it starts to become heavier and it starts to fall back. But the Earth's surface is curved, so how can it essentially fall back? In trying to understand that, we essentially built an analogy associated with taking a ping pong ball and you push it hard enough, or if you're a very good ping pong player, hit it so hard that it essentially puckers. And when it puckers along a curve. Or you take a Coke can or a Coke bottle and you push on it and it also puckers and it puckers along a curve. Or you take a balloon, which you may have painted, and then you allow it to deflate and also puckers along a curve. And so this essentially gives you an analogy on the everyday scale of what could happen when I shrink the surface of the Earth 1,000 kilometers or 6,000 kilometers in radius down to the scale where we can essentially use our intuition to essentially build an experiment. And if we do that, we can essentially then create a mathematical analogy. As I said, mathematics is the study of patterns, and if you study patterns and you're trying to understand how patterns relate to each other, and these analogies are useful because they allow us to switch from one kind of system to another. For example, in fact, even though mountains look like they are solid and the Earth that we stand on is solid on the scale of our lifetime, it flows on the scale of millions and hundreds of millions of years, going back all the way as it was described in the Bible itself. And one can use computer simulations to essentially create a simulation of what this continental shelf looks like as it starts to collapse, and then one can essentially create mathematical formalisms which allow you to make predictions. So we start with a description, that of island arcs. We create an analogy, and then we use this analogy to essentially make predictions which we can just test, not only on our Earth, but increasingly, hopefully, over the next decades, as we start coming across extrasolar planets, we can essentially test whether similar things happen elsewhere outside our Earth. And that's the power of mathematics, the ability to essentially jump from one problem to the other using analogies and using calculations. My second vignette switches from consideration of the physical world to the biological world and to ourselves. This is an image of a human brain. This is an image of a fetal brain as it progresses through development, starting from the folds that first form about 20 weeks after gestation and then reaching more or less their mature state just before birth. Of all the iconic images that you see in biology, perhaps the one that exemplifies complexity is essentially that of the brain folding itself. How does this happen, and why is it important? If you have a folded brain, by the way, we are not the only organisms which have these. If you have a folded brain, then you have a large number of neurons which can be packed in a small volume with a very small wiring length, which means that you have the ability to essentially create and process information very, very quickly, and therefore perhaps increase your cognitive capacity. What is the origin of these folds? One can essentially ask how to quantify these folds by looking at how it changes over time. It's characterized by something called the gyrification index, which just basically tells you what the actual area of the brain is compared to the area of the surface itself. That increases. Our humans have one of the largest gyrification indices, and one can ask, how does this happen? In fact, it happens because neurons deep inside the brain migrate as we develop from the inside towards the surface, increasing the surface too much, and a consequence of increasing the surface too much is that the whole thing folds. So can we understand that? And again, we can use mathematics and we can use analogies. How did we do this? We built an experiment with a piece of gel, actually something rather similar to Jell-O. You can use printing to essentially create a model of the human fetal brain. You put it in a dish which causes the gel to swell because it absorbs liquid from the outside. And you can see in 15 minutes or so, this is a movie that's been sped up, in 15 minutes or so, you essentially are able to see the same patterns that you actually get on the surface of a brain, except on a piece of gel. You understand that even better if you create a mathematical and a computer simulation. So this is one that I'm showing you over here. And that allows you to eventually start looking at the correlations between the real brain and a simulated brain. So what's happened over here? What have we basically learned? We can simulate computationally and mimic physically both normal and abnormal brain growth and link them to morphologies which are normal and dysmorphologies. And so if there are functional consequences, as there are, because different parts of the folded brain are associated with different functions, loss of function and loss of folds correlate with each other, and mathematics allows you to essentially make some sense of it. Okay? So I've told you a little bit about the physical world. I've told you about the biological world. I want to now move to my third and last vignette, using mathematics to describe and predict the behavior of matter as it is in the non-living world, and move beyond that to essentially design a world that never was. Artists and children, of course, do this all the time. For example, you may be interested in folding a piece of paper and creating origami, okay, from the Japanese ori for fold and kami for paper. Everybody, I'm sure, has attempted to create a butterfly, a crane, or a kite. And everybody, I'm sure, has also been thwarted in trying to create a dragon. Okay, you've been thwarted metaphorically, you've been thwarted physically, and you've been probably thwarted mentally as well. Which begs the question, can you essentially move between something which is perfectly periodic? So this is essentially what you might think of as the hydrogen atom of an origami. How can you go from the perfectly periodic to a dragon by modulating the folds, moving the folds around, and ending up here rather than over there? Okay? Can you do that? So can you essentially create something which is somewhere in between this, which is the result of almost every calculation that I've ever done, But it's not so bad, because if I have a crumpled piece of paper, I can use it to drape my hand. I can use it perhaps to drape my body. And I can maybe even use it to drape my head, all of which are very different. Some things are cylindrical, some things are saddle-shaped. So can I do better? Can I go between that and this object, okay, which a student of mine essentially built, but it's perfectly periodic. So this is kind of boring. This is also kind of boring. Can we go in between? And mathematics allows us to do that. In fact, on the top, you can see the results of some calculations that we did, allowing us to become tailors, but mathematical tailors, using origami to create spheres, saddles, pillboxes, candelabrums, and vases. And then we can essentially build them. Okay? I want to finish by saying that not only can we do that, we can essentially move beyond and not only create folded patterns, but also growth patterns, allowing us to essentially do something like build a flower, an orchid. This is a calculation. That's the real thing. Based on the calculation built now from printing inks, clever kinds of inks, on a flat sheet, and then allowing it to dip, putting the whole thing in water and allowing it to swell. And you can even grow a face. Using mathematics, we can essentially create these complex structures. Each one of these adventures started with observations, led to an abstraction mathematically, allowed us to analyze things, and then allowed us to move further. I started with the poet Blake. I'll end with the painter Picasso. Okay? And what you see over here is a series of sketches of a bull, which describe exactly the same process that a mathematician or a scientist essentially uses when they are faced with complex problems. You have the real object. In fact, you have something which perhaps is not quite something like the real object because you haven't observed it carefully. You start observing it carefully and it becomes more and more realistic and more complex. And then you start stripping away what you can until you have the essence of a bull. Taking away any more, you wouldn't recognize it. Adding more basically doesn't really add so much if I'm trying to describe and make a connection to you. So the same ideas associated with mathematics appear in art. They appear as abstraction, they appear as analysis, and they appear as analogy. How do we not get overwhelmed by the detail? How do we not leave out the essence? I'm going to stop here. Many of you will not become scientists or mathematicians. But just as one doesn't have to be an artist to appreciate art, one doesn't have to be a scientist or a mathematician to appreciate the wonders around us and in us. While science today is thought of first and foremost as the engine of progress in the world around, I think it can, and I think it should be equally an aesthetic and artistic endeavor, a natural expression of our innate curiosity as humans. There is mystery and magic even in the everyday world, and what is more, it can be experienced all the time by all of you. Make this a habit and share it, and good luck with your decision.